Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our weekly Constitutional Law podcast. This week marks the wrap-up of our new material before the midterm exam. I'm sure you're so excited to talk about that. We are going to be delving into what is called administrative law. And administrative law is not talked about in your textbook. It's really an area of law that doesn't get a whole lot of hands-on treatment when talking about constitutional law. And I think that's a pretty big oversight because when we talk about administrative law versus congressional legislation or standard legislation, there is so much more administrative law out there. So for this week, we're going to step into that world, talk more about that. I'm going to begin with a description and discussion of the bureaucracy, which is responsible for the creation of administrative law. And then we'll talk about the process, a little bit about the history, and jump right into those cases for this week. Hopefully by now, this is feeling a bit like a routine for you where I say things like, hey, now go ahead and open up the week 7 slides so that you can know what I'm talking about. And that's exactly what I'm asking you to do right now. So open up those slides posted on the week 7 roadmap page. We don't have too many slides to get through. There's a total of 19, but there's a lot of content behind these. So fingers crossed we can wrap this in about an hour. But let's turn back to those slides. Our objectives for this week, for this episode, we want to understand more about bureaucracy and administrative power, get the explanation of what administrative law is. Then we're going to turn to what's called the Administrative Procedures Act, because that guides a huge amount of what happens with administrative law. It's really the process and the way the game is played, so to speak. Next, we will delve a bit into one of the readings for this week, the milestones in the evolution of the administrative state. I'm not going to go too far down that rabbit hole because I would like for you to read it on your own time. Not a terribly long read, but very interesting in the way that the author traces out how the administrative state has expanded and contracted in relation to the actions of different leaders and presidents. And we'll close with a discussion of the 3 cases for this week. The Chevron case is perhaps one of the most famous with respect to administrative law. And then just this year, it was overruled. So we're going to dig into the cases where it was overruled, as well as talk about some recent decisions from the Supreme Court that have pretty strong and significant implications for administrative agencies. First things first, however, let's talk about what bureaucracy is. Now, I would assume that none of you have heard the term bureaucracy as a positive term. It doesn't carry happy-go-lucky connotations. We don't tend to think of bureaucracy as a benefit. But it really is the backbone of the executive branch. If we didn't have our bureaucracy and the administrative agencies that carry out so much of the executive's functions, we really wouldn't get stuff done. And that's no understatement. Whether you love or hate bureaucracy, it really does function for the purpose of carrying into effect all of the laws that Congress passes, all of the programs that Congress creates. In essence, anything that comes from the legislative branch has to be handed off to the executive to put these things into action. And the administrative state or the administrative agencies that fall under the executive branch really are the responsible entities for all of that implementation. And that's really a key word for administration, implementation. They may create some policies, and in this case, we're going to talk about how administrative entities create law, which really are mostly rules and regulations, but they still carry the weight of law. But without these entities, you have a whole lot of things that don't ever happen. You don't have environmental protection without the Environmental Protection Agency, which is created by Congress in the 1970s, or at least you don't have environmental protection the way it looks today. Now, again, love it or hate it, that really is just saying without the administration, without these agencies and this portion of the executive branch, we just don't have government the way it exists today. Moving on to slide four, what you can see there is an infographic type approach to presenting and describing what the bureaucracy is. This is an organizational structure or organizational kind of chart for the Constitution, as the front end of that graphic shows, with the pink being the White House or the executive branch, the blue being the Congress, and the green being the Supreme Court. Now, what you'll notice is that there is very little that pushes all the way out from the green or the blue, but there is a ton on the right-hand side that stems from the executive branch. This is the bureaucracy. All of the independent agencies, commissions, entities, even government corporations responsible for, again, putting into effect the policies that are passed by our government. I hope you notice in looking at this graphic that there is a little bit of Congress playing into the structures on the right-hand side, that big long tail and listing of entities, and that is because Congress does play a fundamentally important role with these. Generally, what Congress is doing in the process of creating the administrative agencies is delegating, as we've discussed in prior podcasts and in the slides on legislative powers. Now, of course, there are entities that have been created by the executive for the express purpose of putting into effect policy, but a lot of this does stem from Congress initially saying it is going to hand over the power on some topic or create some entity to follow up on what it once done with respect to, let's say, nuclear power or monetary policy or even the happenings of the stock market. With each of these entities that fall under, let's say, independent regulatory commission status, there is often legislation that dates back some years ago where Congress says, we want this done and we're willing to delegate out this power or hand it over to a portion of the executive that is created for the express purpose of managing this issue. A lot of what we see in the administrative state or in these administrative agencies is the creation of entities following on to problems. We might have massive pollution events that we need to address. We might have concerns about the security of our power grid. We might need to find a way to oversee the rail system in a different fashion than what has existed before Congress intervenes. So much of this is policy creation based on the identification of a problem and subsequently, again, designation of a specific entity in the bureaucracy to manage it. Now, I've mentioned a few different terms up to this point in time, and I want to clarify on slide five some important definitions. First, we have what are called independent agencies or independent regulatory commissions. They are truly independent of the president and the executive branch by virtue of not being able to just be fired by the president. So their independence in the label is from direct oversight or being right under the thumb of the presidency. And this establishes some legitimacy in terms of it's not just going to be an entity or agency that immediately lines up with the president each and every time. The purpose here is to ensure that independence from political influence. So we think perhaps of an example like the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is responsible for setting interest policy and monetary policy for the United States. And you don't want that entity to be totally under the thumb of the president because the current president might decide to manipulate that agency to ensure their continued reelection or use threats of increased interest rates if they aren't reelected. That kind of approach would fundamentally interfere with the notion of free and fair elections. So the essence behind this is these are entities or bodies that do exist separate from the president, separate from the executive to a certain extent, not completely, but they do have the ability to stand on their own and don't immediately come under fire for making decisions that may be politically unpopular. A second and also important type of bureaucratic entity or administrative entity is what's known as a government corporation. Now, corporations created by the government are intended to be market-oriented. So they're trying to provide a service to the public, and they're generally charging for that service. And the reason the government steps in often with these types of entities is because it would be unfeasible or unacceptable to a private entity to take care of providing that service because of the costs versus the benefits. To be clear, these government corporations are supposed to cover their own costs, but we're not looking at profit-heavy types of industries. So the examples listed on the slide are the Social Security Administration and the U.S. Postal Service. And those entities, while they are responsible for doling out government benefits or services, don't really see a huge return on that investment. And we have other government corporations like Amtrak. The passenger rail service across the United States is actually a government corporation, or something like Unicor, which is the business operations side of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. This allows for inmate employment in those prisons, and they produce items ranging from office products to furniture. Now, all of these bureaucratic entities have their own structure and their own setup or rules and regulations, but they're also empowered to create rules and regulations for the rest of us. So the Postal Service puts guidance around what you can mail. It's not just simply the rules and regulations for the Postal Service, but we all have to adhere to those regulations. There's certain things you cannot send through the mail. That is straight up illegal. And the Postal Service gets to have a great deal of say over that. And that's the general gist behind administrative agencies, is they are creating rules and regulations for the public good or the general good of everyone in the United States. And based on that premise, we empower these administrative agencies to do what they need to do to create that public good. So you can have entities like the Environmental Protection Agency or the EPA put limits on where you can build homes so that you are preserving different zones of wildlife or ensuring conservation. There is a very particular process, however, that the EPA must follow in order to create and enforce those rules. And that process is guided by the Administrative Procedures Act, which is outlined briefly starting on slide 6. Slide 6 is a snippet from the Justia page on administrative law called the Administrative Law Center. And really what is it is detailing there is how an administrative agency goes about creating administrative law. So in 1946, Congress adopts this Administrative Procedures Act, and this is following on a huge amount of bureaucratic creation post Great Depression. We had the New Deal and we had FDR, and there was a lot of things that got created in that time period. And we didn't have a whole lot of corralling of those different entities or agencies. And that naturally leads to some questions about accountability, as in, how do we ensure that this administrative wing of the executive branch is actually accountable to the people? Well, one option is this APA or Administrative Procedures Act, which at the very least ensures that there is public notice of proposed laws. Slide 7 is going to break down that APA into a very basic 3 steps. The first step is that the administrative agency needs to propose the rule in what is called the Federal Register. And the Federal Register is the journal of what the government does. It's documentation of all the different rules, regulations, and laws. It is frankly huge. I have it listed on this slide at being over 80,000 pages long, but I believe when I looked it up the other day, it was actually listed as being over 185,000 pages. So, you know, just a light read for your Saturday. But setting that little tidbit of knowledge aside, once the rule's been proposed, the agency has to allow for what is known as a public comment period. And this is basically our chance to give input about what do we think about this proposed rule or regulation. The comment period is usually open for at least 45 days. If there is something really contentious about the proposal, the agency may decide to offer the chance for hearings, or someone from the public may actually request a hearing. It's not guaranteed, but it is possible that this could be done. Now, once the public comment period closes, the agency has to review the feedback. It actually also has to produce a report about the comment period. And if it gets a lot of pushback, there is a real possibility that the agency will go back and revise their proposal and then have to do another public comment period. So say we get through all of these steps and we're ready to move forward with our rule or regulation. It then has to go to the OAL, or Office of Administrative Law, which reviews it, makes sure that the APA process was followed, and then publishes the final rule. And at that point, ladies and gentlemen, we have a new administrative law, or regulation or rule. All of these labels get thrown around interchangeably, but that is the process for creating administrative law, which is very, very different than what we experience through congressional legislation. And just to starkly contrast it, we have seen congressional legislation dive off in terms of its actual production. So Congress has gone from having hundreds of bills passed a year to roughly somewhere around 30 different bills enacted. But administrative law has really, really ballooned and expanded, which can account for why the Federal Register is so huge at this point in time. So what is really unique about the administrative law is not just the process of it, but it can actually also control any decisions about how to challenge that process. On slide 8, what I've noted is that whichever agency or entity makes the rule can actually put into place requirements to challenge their decision or to challenge their rule. So they may require you to go through arbitration or some non-court tied procedure, protecting themselves in a certain way because if you don't have it go to the courts, maybe it can't be struck down as unconstitutional. It could be found that maybe it's a violation, but the process still has to go through the in-house procedure before it can even be turned over to the courts. Of course, all of this structure and all of this bureaucracy didn't just come about magically one day. It's taken a very long time to build it up. And for this reason, I've included the milestones in the evolution of the administrative state reading for this week. Our author does a really nice job of talking about how the administrative state and the bureaucracy have grown and expanded. And you'll notice that there is specific language used both by me and by this author. I say the administrative state not because I want to use the most politically charged version of that label, but I want to make clear that what we are talking about is the bureaucracy, aka the administrative state. What has become commonplace with a lot of the language in politics is that we come up with specific labels to tap into our specific audience, or our respective audience, that is, and we use that to get a strong emotional reaction. So administrative state, I'm going to say very flatly, because for me, it just means the bureaucracy. And yet, you probably won't ever hear it described in such robotic terms, for lack of a better word. As you work through that piece, and it's really only around 16 pages total, so definitely not even as dense or as long as a regular chapter, but when you're reading through it, I'd like you to consider a few questions related to what the author is proposing and talking about in terms of the evolution of the bureaucracy. First, what are the milestones, the 4 milestones that are referenced in that piece specifically? She does point out that there are 4 key events that have changed the trajectory of the bureaucracy or administrative state, and I'd like you to pick those out from the reading. They're pretty clear, but if you have any questions about that, do let me know and I will get back to you on those. The next thing I'd like you to think about is, in what area does each milestone appear to have its focus? And by this, I mean economic policy, social policy, what's the emphasis at the time? Because really what we're working with in terms of the evolution of these entities, of the administration, generally speaking, is whatever is at the forefront of the policymaker minds of that time and that era. So it's no surprise that in the Great Depression, we're talking about economic entities, right? Because at that point, our priority is to rebuild an economy that has fallen off a cliff and needs to be resuscitated. But later on, we get to more social policy because we start to deal with things like the civil rights movement or considerations of, let's say, drug use and how is that affecting society and thinking about criminal justice policy. All of these things are inherently tied together, so I want you to reflect on what those milestones are about and are focusing on. And then I'd really like you to think critically about each milestone. What are the positives and negatives that go with each one? And what are the positives and negatives in terms of their ramifications for the administrative state? And somewhat separately, but also in a related kind of vein, I want you to think about, what about the proposals at the end of this piece? Things like judicial oversight, legislative action, retrospective analysis, or extension of oversight are all put forth as potential future milestones of the administrative state. What do you think should or needs to happen with respect to this bureaucracy, these agencies and entities that have, frankly, a great deal of power and that are never discussed once in the Constitution because they perhaps just weren't envisioned? Or if they were, it really was never in the format that we have today. I do give great credit to many of the founders and framers for having the ability to think well down the line from even their own lifetimes, but let's be honest, it's a little difficult to imagine things like the internet or nuclear power in the 1700s. Okay, take your time with that reading. Make sure you give yourself enough of a chance to evaluate that history, think about those questions. Again, it's not a terribly long piece, and I think it's a really nice, solid grounding in the history of the bureaucracy and the creation of what we now call the administrative state, or at least some people do. And then when you've done all that, let's now turn finally to discussion of our cases for this week. The first case on that agenda is Chevron USA versus Natural Resources Defense Council, Inc. And you'll note that I've listed to read the full opinion. The full opinion is about 30 pages total. So this is a much briefer opinion than what we might encounter presently with other cases that we see from the Supreme Court, which can run hundreds of pages long. And I do really want you to grapple with understanding this. Now, as you're reading, first, note that the syllabus for this case is roughly 2 pages. The prior cases I'd been having you look at were syllabi with, you know, 6, 7, 8 pages. So this tends to be a little bit quicker, more to the point. And when you read older Supreme Court cases, you're going to notice that they are not nearly as lengthy as the ones we have today. In part because I think that they more adequately simplified the legal questions that were being undertaken. And also because we had many, many fewer concurring and dissenting opinions as part of the overall decision for the court. Let's dive into that syllabus. And the first thing you're going to notice is this is in reference to a case involving the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and pollution standards. Don't get too sidetracked by the technicality. What you're reading on page 1 is a description of what has happened so far, and we have these Clean Air Act amendments in 1977 that say, essentially, if you aren't meeting the goals regarding pollution or pollution reduction, then you have to have this permitting process in place, and you can issue permits unless they meet the conditions. So in essence, EPA is trying to reduce emissions, reduce pollution in the air. Now, what happens in the process of this case is we find that there are some maybe not so clear definitions or explanations. And really, this is what the Chevron case is all about, is when we have something that is unclear or perhaps not totally specified in the most directive ways, how do we know what it means? And you can see on the headline for this, the line is simply, the EPA's plant-wide definition is a permissible construction of the statutory term stationary source. And frankly, that's the overall ruling in the case. So the EPA's explanation of what that means is okay, and we can use that for now. That can be accepted as constitutional. In fact, I love this syllabus even further because just below the statement of what is held, it simply says under bullet point or bullet lettering A, with regard to judicial review of an agency's construction of the statute which it administers, if Congress has not directly spoken to the precise question at issue, the question for the court is whether the agency's answer is based on a permissible construction of the statute. So here the Supreme Court is saying, if we get a challenge like this, then all we have to determine is whether the agency has a permissible or acceptable explanation of the language in the law. And this comes to be known as what is called Chevron deference. Chevron deference is defined on slide 14, and it's simply explained as a level of respect given to an administrative agency's understanding or interpretation of a law, which means that as long as an agency has a reasonable approach to applying or explaining what the law means, the Supreme Court's going to go along with that. That deference is the Supreme Court saying to the agency, we recognize you as valid authorities. Maybe we'd even go so far as to say you're experts, and we're not going to question that expertise so long as what you're saying makes sense and is reasonable. Now, if only Supreme Court opinions were so straightforward and simple in their explanation as what I've just put forth, we really wouldn't have that much reading in this class. But the rest of the syllabus in this case goes on to trace out what the court did to try and assess whether going with an agency's interpretation makes sense. They look at the legislation and the history. Did Congress mean a certain thing when they talked about this notion of a bubble concept? Again, not so important that you get bubble concept, but that you evaluate what the court is doing, what strategy it's using here. It's actually employing originalism because it's looking at the intent of the law when it was passed. Intent is also going to be a focus at subpoint E here. When we're looking at whether there was congressional intent from the statutory language. So again, they're reading into what is the intention behind this law. But you're also seeing here use of textualism because they're talking about specific terms that are used and what is the meaning of those terms. We have a few key terms that are pulled out in this syllabus. First, we have stationary source. Then they have in parentheses bubble concept, and they go further into talking about source later in their explanation. We're definitely delving not just into the history or the intention behind the law, but the actual words that were used and whether those words carried a specific meaning. So we're employing two different interpretation strategies here to try and identify what's going on with the legislation. And is this administrative agency acting in a way that is contradicting that legislation or pursuing the legislation's purpose? I think if you're struggling with the larger explanation of this case that comes from the syllabus, I would direct you to page 842, section 2, where Justice Stevens, the justice who is writing this opinion, is laying out more of the direct questions the court needs to answer in this case. So here's how it reads. When a court reviews an agency's construction of the statute which it administers, it is confronted with two questions. First, always, is the question whether Congress has directly spoken to the precise question at issue. If the intent of Congress is clear, that is the end of the matter. For the court as well as the agency must give effect to the unambiguously expressed intent of Congress. If, however, the court determines Congress has not directly addressed the precise question at issue, the court does not simply impose its own construction on the statute, as would be necessary in the absence of an administrative interpretation. Rather, if the statute is silent or ambiguous with respect to the specific issue, the question for the court is whether the agency's answer is based on a permissible construction of the statute. A quick translation on that. What he's saying is, if we don't know what Congress meant, we can't just set aside what the administrative agency says. And if what they say is reasonable, we really do need to acknowledge that and go with it. Reading just a little bit further onto page 837 of the opinion, the power of an administrative agency to administer a congressionally created program necessarily requires the formulation of policy and the making of rules to fill any gap left implicitly or explicitly by Congress. If Congress has explicitly left a gap for the agency to fill, there is an express delegation of authority to the agency to elucidate a specific provision of the statute by regulation. Okay, forgiving the large words, here's the translation. If Congress gave them this power and they've left it questionable, we should assume that they have given the power to the agency to define what the law says. So we need to let them do that. The remainder of this opinion is going to go through a lot of the history around how this specific issue was dealt with, or how the court has approached agencies defining things with respect to the law. But really what you need to get out of this is that whole concept of Chevron deference, where the court says if it's questionable and whatever administrative agency is involved with it gives us something that's reasonable to work with that doesn't seem to violate the law or the Constitution, we're good to go with that. Okay, on that note, I want you to step back and think. What does this mean for administrative power? How does this expand the power of the bureaucracy? And why was it taken as such a huge vote in favor of bureaucratic power? And I don't think you'll have to think too long about it, because really what it comes down to is if you have the power to define what the law says, then really you are setting the law. You may be the law. And your explanations are going to stand on their own in a court of law. You will win the case because it is your interpretation that stands, not the interpretations of others, even if those others may also have reasonable explanations or interpretations of what a law says. All right, so Chevron occurs in 1984, and it is a unanimous opinion. By unanimous, we mean the vote was 6-0, because three of the justices did not participate in the decision. But nonetheless, it is a unanimous opinion, so it stands up pretty clearly that in this case, the Supreme Court is acknowledging there's a level of deference to administrative agencies, particularly when it is a questionable issue. Not necessarily the case if Congress has given us a clear definition or explanation of their intent, or if they've addressed something in the law and written it out as such, but if it's questionable or not so clear, we can go ahead with what the agency says is the case. The case of Chevron creates the principle, as I've noted before, of Chevron deference, which means deference with respect to an agency when it comes to a law that is passed that has some content which isn't clear. But the Supreme Court also extended this idea with what is known as our deference, A-U-E-R. This is also defined on slide 14. So when it comes to administrative regulations, and not necessarily federal law, if there's an ambiguous rule, as long as the agency's approach to interpreting that rule is not completely wrong or out of line, which they call plainly erroneous or inconsistent, then we can go with that agency's approach and interpretation. But if it's totally off base, we can't defer to them on that. So the Chevron deference is for federal legislation. The our deference is for regulations or rules, aka administrative law. In these two cases, you have the kind of twin pillars being set up here of deference to administrative entities, regardless of whether it is laws passed by Congress or laws created by an administrative entity, so long as those interpretations are generally reasonable and not inconsistent with whatever is going on with the rest of the law or the rule. But here's where the story gets really fun, because fast forward 40 years to 2024, and the Supreme Court is going to kick back against precedent and rule in Loper Bright v. Raimondo that Chevron deference is no more. For this case, I've asked you to simply read the syllabus, which is about pages 1 through 8, because the entire opinion in the Loper Bright case is 114 pages. And that's frankly a lot to take in, especially when we're talking about the technical details in this case. So Loper Bright doesn't really have that much or anything directly to do with the content of the Chevron case, which is pollution, but Loper Bright is about administrative rules. And what you'll see listed in the first paragraph of the syllabus is that explicitly in this case, the court was considering whether the Chevron case should be overruled or clarified. And they write, under the Chevron doctrine, courts have sometimes been required to defer to permissible agency interpretations of the statutes those agencies administer, even when a reviewing court reads the statute differently. In each case below, the reviewing courts applied Chevron's framework to resolve in favor of the government challenges by petitioners to a rule promulgated by the National Marine Fisheries Service pursuant to the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which incorporates the Administrative Procedure Act, going all the way back to that process we first talked about. Now, under the held section of this syllabus, the decision is, the Administrative Procedure Act requires courts to exercise their independent judgment in deciding whether an agency has acted within its statutory authority, and courts may not defer to an agency interpretation of the law simply because a statute is ambiguous. Chevron is overruled. Okay, folks, we are seeing here one very specific method not being used, and that would be the approach of precedent. We are in fact overturning a past decision or overruling it, which means we reject what precedent has told us, and we're offering a different analysis of the legal question or the case. I want you to continue reading through the syllabus, and on page 3 is where the court is going to clarify that they believe the past interpretation of the Administrative Procedure Act under Chevron was incorrect. What they note under point B is that the APA prescribes procedures for agency action and delineates the basic contours of judicial review of such action. It makes clear that courts, not agencies, will decide all relevant questions of law. And this is fundamentally the basis for overruling Chevron. The court is rereading the APA and saying that the APA, which is passed by Congress, makes clear that the process we have been using is not what they intended. What they intended was clearly laid out in the APA, so we can no longer just defer to administrative agencies as to what they think questionable or ambiguous laws mean. We have to actually step in as the courts and engage in true judicial review. We just cannot defer anymore. The remainder of that syllabus is going to really dig into Chevron. But what's so interesting about this is you really don't get any of the details of the actual case that Loper Bright is bringing. Because again, Loper Bright isn't about pollution standards. It's in fact about these rules that the National Marine Fisheries Service oversees as delegated to them by the Secretary of Commerce. So this has to do with trade, and this has to do with fishing. And the overall story is this. Because they're trying to conserve and they're trying to protect these fisheries, then we have catch limits, right? So that overfishing doesn't happen. And part of what is involved with policing these efforts so that we aren't overfishing is having observers on board a boat. Not only do the observers need to be on the boat, the observers need to be paid, and they're supposed to be covered according to the law by the fishing vessels themselves, right? There are certain vessels which may not have to pay. But when we're talking about it, there's fees for having these observers, and the law requires who's ever carrying the observers to pay the fees generally. And that takes us to the original complaint. So Loper Bright refers to Loper Bright Enterprises, And that was one of two family fishing businesses that filed this case. And what they said was the existing rule was ambiguous. It didn't mandate that they had to pay for the observers. So this goes to court, and the court says, well, we're going to defer to the agency under Chevron because that's what exists right now. So the Supreme Court, once it hits this case, is saying, we're not only ruling in this case, we're overturning this Chevron deference, and now we're not going to simply accept what agencies say. We're going to have to look at it independently as courts and use true judicial review. For this case, please do try to work through all of the syllabus. It's not terribly long, and it really is a nice description of the history. Yes, I know it is the Supreme Court writing, so it's going to be technical. There's going to be lots of big words that they throw in there, but it might be one of the more readable syllabi that I have seen. It's also an interesting syllabus in that while they are overruling a past case, there are tons of citations to other past cases that they reference. So at the same time, the Supreme Court in this case is not going with precedent. There are other precedents that they do cite to back up their decision. It's a really interesting interplay of recognition of some past cases and not others. So now let's move on to the case of Garland v. Cargill, which is another administrative power case and also has to do with agencies being able to do things independently and have those actions recognized as valid by the court, or in this case, not so valid. If you begin with the syllabus for this case, it's a lot more straightforward and easier to understand than what happens with Chevron or Loperbright. Because what we're talking about is firearms related and what happens following the Las Vegas shooting that took place in 2017. What I will say about this case is that it is not so difficult in terms of the case facts and certainly the gravity of what happened during that event in 2017, but I want you to focus in on what it has to say about administrative power and specifically what is described in the syllabus at the bottom of page 1 and the start of page 2. In particular, what is held by the court is that the ATF, an administrative agency or entity, exceeded its statutory authority by issuing a rule that classifies a bump stock as a machine gun. So what's happening here in this case is that the ATF has reclassified bump stocks to qualify them as machine guns, which are prohibited under federal law. The ATF makes this rule change following the Vegas shooting, and it then ordered people to turn over their bump stocks, as in surrender them, or destroy them so that they wouldn't be held criminally accountable for having them. But prior to this point in time, the ATF had consistently held that bump stocks were not machine guns according to the definition. And the definition is that a machine gun is any weapon which shoots, is designed to shoot, or can be readily restored to shoot automatically more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. Okay, do not get all caught up in the language around the firearms on this. I know that is incredibly easy to do because this definitely seems like a firearms and a Second Amendment case, but it's not. That is a deceptive practice at play here. Yes, there are ramifications for bump stocks as a result of this decision, but it's simply taking bump stocks back to what it was considered before the Las Vegas shooting. So this is not a huge extension of the Second Amendment. It's not a huge restriction of it. What it is an initial and immediate pushback on the rulemaking authority of the ATF, when beforehand, what might have been allowed is that the ATF decides to change a rule, but in this case, they are not. When it was initially brought, the Cargill case did not involve Chevron deference, but it was eventually incorporated when it went to the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, also known as the DC Circuit. So at the DC Circuit, they said, according to Chevron, the ATF's rule was a reasonable interpretation to call a bump stock a machine gun or something like that under the definition that was laid out, that was fine. But instead, what we see with this Supreme Court opinion is a revisiting of the language and a pushback, of course, an overruling of Chevron in relation to at least this specific case and all cases going forward. So Chevron now would be called a dead case or a dead doctrine because it no longer applies. It does not stand as a precedent that guides future decisions. These cases and the larger topic of administrative law has really come under the inspection and investigation of the Supreme Court much more in the last few years. And there have been quite a few different cases that have challenged the power of the bureaucracy and administrative entities, again, also known as the administrative state. The final reading for this week that I have listed for you is an interview about the very many different court opinions on administrative power and the administrative state and what has been changed in the last couple of years with respect to those powers. I'd really like for you to take some time to read through that interview. It's not tremendously long, and it does reference other cases that were undertaken or adopted by the court this year. If you prefer, there's an actual audio version listed at the top. It's a 6-minute listen. You can just push the play button up there and learn a little bit more about what this means for administrative law. And in addition to that, if you go back to the Week 7 Roadmap page, I have listed several different podcasts on this week's material because it's a little difficult to understand, but a ton of different podcasts broadcast episodes on this topic because for nerds of the Supreme Court world, this was a huge case and there were multiple huge cases that had a lot to do with the power of the administrative state and the bureaucracy. And so again, take a look at that list from the podcasts to accompany this week's material. There's quite a few I've listed on Spotify that might be a nice addition to what you're doing with the reading and listening to this episode, as well as looking over the slides. Okay, let's close things out today with a high note. Number one, there are no required assignments this week. Give us a nice little break before we roll into the midterm, which is, as you no doubt gathered, the not so high note, but I don't think it's that bad, of course, being the instructor. We do have our midterm exam coming up next week. Now, for that exam, we have no new materials. In addition, I will be doing a very brief podcast that will be mostly about strategies for how to successfully navigate and manage the midterm. But I'm also going to list those out at the end of this episode just because it's good to do so before we hit the first day of the exam. So, tip number one, the exam will open up for you on Sunday, October 6th, as of 12:01 a.m. It's just how I set them up. It's nothing particular about me wanting you to be awake at midnight on Saturday night. So that means you will be able to look at all of the questions on the exam as of Sunday the 6th. Okay, tip number two, don't wait until the exam is due or the last weekend you can work on it to look at the questions. Look at them early in the week. And keep in mind, you need to read through all of the guidelines for the exam and not do too much work. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that you are only supposed to answer one question per section, and there are 5 sections on this exam. So do not, repeat, do not answer 10 questions, answer 5. I offer this suggestion in literally every class I have, and undoubtedly I will get one exam where someone has gone to the work of doing twice what they need to do. And if you do that, I'm only going to grade the first question in each section. So it tends to have negative ramifications, not just for someone's mental health and stress and sleep, but also on their grade because trying to answer 10 questions is a lot more difficult than trying to answer just 5. So take your time with it. Figure out which question per section you want to answer and only answer one per section. Tip 3. I take a lot of time, it may not seem like it, but I do take a lot of time to work on the slides for these courses. And those slides are selected out and framed the way they are because I think those are the most critical and most relevant points for the course. Hint, hint, that might be the best study guide you can have for the upcoming exam. So go back to the slides. And of course, the slides are my emphasis when I have these podcast episodes created. So again, take that for what it is, take the note that I'm offering, and utilize that to your advantage. Tip number 4, do not wait. Do not wait until the last few days to work on the exam. It is a very bad weekend if you spend all weekend working on this, and it is a much better week if you space it out. You do not have to sit down and do this exam in one sitting, so you are able to stretch it out over multiple days. That seems to be the strategy that leads to the best scores based on students I have talked to, because again, you're trying to balance that with the rest of life, and doing a bit here and a bit there is much easier than cramming it all into 8 hours at one time. Of course, I have had students do that. It's just a very stressful and oftentimes less successful strategy than giving yourself a little bit more time and a few more days to work on it. Finally, this is not a tip, but this is one of the guidelines for the exam. This test is open note, open book, open online resource, but this needs to be your work only. So no collaboration with anyone, no past course participants, no current course participants, no family members, no friends who are attorneys, nothing from people who aren't you. And the reason I do this is quite simple. For me, I'm trying to assess your mastery of the material using this exam. I'm not trying to fail you. I'm not trying to bring you down, but I am trying to give you an accurate reflection of how well you know the material and how well you do with the general topic of constitutional law. And I can't very well give you an accurate reflection unless I know what I have is yours and your work only. So please choose to write in your own words. Avoid tools like Grammarly or anything that has to do with AI. And in fact, if you use AI, that's going to be a big problem because that's not giving me your voice. So stay away from those. No ChatGPT, no Perplexity AI, none of that kind of stuff. Do write in your own words. Your explanations really give me more insight into you. And it also helps you understand whether you really understand something or not. Having to explain it to another person using your own language and not quotes from Google, a really effective tool for our own evaluation of our learning and mastery of a topic. All right, we are done for this week. We have kept it under an hour, which is awesome. I will have a brief podcast next week regarding the midterm. Again, it'll be repetition of a lot of what I've described in this episode, but I will come back and offer those thoughts. Have a great rest of your day, rest of your week, and I look forward to connecting with you again in the near future.